This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. We have our panel of trumpet writers here ready and eager to discuss the important events of this past week. In the studio here, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be here.
We have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
Via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And via Skype from our office in Jerusalem, we have Brent Nachtigall.
Good to be here.
I'm very excited. We're sending the January edition of the Trumpet Magazine off to press today. Our cover story, no surprise, is about the election of Donald Trump as President of the United States. It's actually more than just the cover story. It fills about 18 pages of the magazine as we explore the ramifications of this development and how they fulfill the prophecies of the Bible. The cover is a portrait of Mr. Trump done by our artist on staff, Gary Dorning, with the headline, Can He Make America Great Again? Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has written an article called America's Coming Civil War, looking at the race-related protests and demonstrations in the United States. He also talks about how we're entering a new phase in America, prophetically speaking. It's a very powerful article I'd like to encourage you to watch for on thetrumpet.com. We also have articles in this edition about what we learned about America through this election, why God calls America a hypocritical nation, how divided we've become between urban Democrats and rural Republicans. We have an article about what we can expect ahead regarding religious freedom, something that's been under siege during the Obama years, but which Mr. Trump says he's going to reverse. And we have articles about how the rest of the world could change in response to what is happening in America, particularly Europe and Asia. On the program today, we're going to take a look at some of the other stories, developments we're seeing in light of America's changing political scene. Our top story today is about Europe and fresh impetus behind the push for a unified European army. We talked about it last week on this program, just how much European leaders are saying that a Trump presidency highlights the need for Europe to really step up and be ready to protect itself and its own interests. Well, this week, EU defense and foreign ministers met to discuss plans to take concrete steps toward a European military. For this story, we're going to go to our man in Britain, Richard.
Yes, this push for EU military, it's just about exactly what we forecast would happen when we spoke about this a few weeks ago. It is some concrete, some very significant steps. Also some ones, though, that are still beset by Europe's usual messy compromises and muddling forward. So what they've agreed to now, EU defense ministers, they met on Monday. EU defense and foreign ministers met on Monday. And one of the things that really, I think, sums up the whole set of agreements is they agreed they were going to set up a European military headquarters. However, this headquarters is very limited. It will only be allowed to be in charge of EU civilian missions, like or EU non-combat missions, like training missions, etc. And there'll be an EU medical command. So it's something just short of a military headquarters. European leaders, like the Italian foreign minister, said that this was not yet a general staff, European general staff, but it was designed to become that. So what we're seeing is, after a lot of talking, some concrete, significant steps towards the European military, but that aren't the full-fledged end result quite yet.
But we do have several European leaders who are pretty excited about the fact that this is getting beyond the talk phase and that there are concrete steps being taken to implement this this plan that's been a long time in the works.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, if you look at this defense headquarters, for example, having a headquarters there, even though it's limited, is a huge step. European nations have talked about this for decades and not managed to accomplish anything. Now, they're maybe two-thirds of the way there towards a European military headquarters, and it's not hard to see how it would be very easy to turn around and say, well, it's just silly having this limited headquarters. Let's make it a full thing. And once you've got the building, the personnel there, that's not hard to do. And European leaders are making no secret of what this is designed to be. The European EU High Representative for Foreign and Security Policy, Federica Mogherini, she's spoken openly about how these steps are designed to turn Europe into a, quote, superpower. Her words, saying Europe needs to become a superpower that believes in multilateralism and cooperation, talking about how Europe can only succeed with the full potential of a superpower in the fields of security and defense. Another EU diplomat said this is more than just blah, blah, blah. There's a new level of political ambition and a document with concrete tasks and a detailed timetable for implementation. So, yes, after years of just watching people talk, we are seeing actual steps. And so I don't want to downplay that at all. And these are actual steps that you can see that can grow very naturally now into a much bigger EU army. Another couple of important outcomes that I'll just draw attention to is they're starting to address this hard question now of the money. Because we've talked about in the past how there's been a lot of talks about, yeah, it'd be great to have this or this or this. And then it just all bogs down when it comes to, well, who pays for it? And this is some of the first time I've seen the money question being addressed when it comes to defense. So two significant things here. Firstly, we've mentioned before how for the last 10 years or so, the European Union has had these EU battle groups, groups of national forces that are meant to be there for the EU to use. Now, one of the big reasons they've never been used is because the country that owns these troops has to pay for the mission. So it's a rotating force. If France is currently currently putting up 1,000 troops as part of this EU battle group, if they deploy anywhere, France foots the bill. So unsurprisingly, no country wants to foot the bill and then for the EU kind of getting all the benefits and the glory, so nothing happens. That is going to change now so that the EU will foot the bill. The money will come out of the European budget. So all of a sudden, those troops can become way more attractive. Now, if France wants to send troops in somewhere, if it does it under the EU umbrella, that cost is now shared with 27 other countries. That's very significant. And then related to that, as part of the euro crisis, EU nations have limited, they put in budgetary rules. They can only borrow up to a certain amount of money. If they go beyond that, they start to get into trouble. They could have fines, etc., imposed upon them. Now, the EU has generally been ignoring those fines, but the rules still carry some weight for nations that want other countries to follow the same rules. They've now changed it so that defense spending will not count in the same way. There's more flexibility within those rules for defense spending. So, for example, again, France, that wants to spend more on its defense but is limited by EU spending rules, well, they can now up their defense spending. So that's something that's going to see... You're already seeing nations, even before this, committing to more defense spending, and now they've made it much easier for a Europe mired in debt to spend more on its military. So those are a couple of very significant steps in terms of addressing the who's going to pay for this thing question as well that has just kind of hung over Europe that has never been really addressed before.
How much was Donald Trump's election? We talked a little bit about just the impetus that has given to those who have been seeking to really add more energy to this discussion about an EU military. Obviously, this meeting was planned long before, but what's your sense of how much that's adding additional impetus to this?
Right. I think this is interesting. I think everything that happened on Monday would have happened even without Donald Trump. I think that those conclusions, those pushes, the meeting, like you said, it was all scheduled in advance. But again, like you said, people are now much more urgent about getting the military together. Just today, the German defense minister said, had a go at Britain for trying to slow things down and said, look, we really need to get an urgent move on this. A country that's about to be leaving shouldn't be slowing up the caravan in this direction. So... we're yet to see Donald Trump's election affect this. It's already moving quickly towards a European military. After that election, I think it's only going to move even faster.
You just have to wonder what Herbert W. Armstrong would think if he saw these headlines and saw these developments, having spoken about this so much over so many years and forecasting the unification of Europe to the point where it had a single military. Stephen Fleury was drawing attention to this on his Trumpet Daily program this morning. We have one quote from Herbert Armstrong in this week's Trumpet Weekly on the story on this this development, but... Really, he talked about Europe unifying in exactly this way for so long, and here we are seeing it happen before our eyes.
Exactly. And another factor of that that just ties into exactly what Mr. Armstrong was saying is it looks like for the first time, Europe might be using its what's called permanent structured cooperation, which is a provision where a much smaller group of nations can move ahead with something without the rest of the EU. They've examined using that before. It's never been used before, but they officially laid the groundwork for implementing that on Monday as well. So what you're looking at now is you could get a much smaller group of nations, and it has to be somewhere, I think it has to be about 8 or 10, but a much smaller group of nations moving forward towards a military, which is exactly another key prophecy of Herbert W. Armstrong, that the European Union would become a 10-nation superpower. And you can see how then all of these different aspects of what, you know, it's not just one thing that we're cherry-picking. The whole picture of the European Union right now and what he's doing matches everything that Mr. Armstrong was saying and writing.
Thank you, Richard. Europe is far from being the only power seeking to increase its military capability in order to confront the threats rising in the world. Many other nations are doing the same, and one of these is China. A new report from a U.S. congressional commission discusses China's militaristic and expansionist activities, and it says they're only going to get stronger. For this story, we're going to go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, this is a new report by the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review. It was published this week, and the authors say something that's probably pretty obvious to most news watchers and most students of geopolitics and Bible prophecy, but they say it with a level of authority, I think, and detail that that makes it worth calling attention to. And that is that what we've seen China do in Djibouti over the last couple of years is only the beginning, and that going forward, China is very likely to keep on building more and more military facilities abroad. So first, just a short review of the Djibouti situation there. It's a tiny country on the Horn of Africa, strategically located right on the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, and Djibouti signed a deal with China back in 2014 to allow China to build its first overseas naval base there. And this deal came in spite of heavy opposition from the United States. And it really represented a major development in China's quest to assert itself, not just as a regional power there in Asia, but as a full-fledged global power. And so now this report by the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review, which is it's a congressional commission that really plays a key role in America's policy toward China, is saying that Djibouti was just the beginning. One quote from this report says, China is likely to continue to seek opportunities to secure military facilities abroad, such as the one it's begun constructing in Djibouti, in order to facilitate a range of operations. And there's a little bit of a chicken and the egg kind of scenario here, which is China building bases in order to protect its expanding global interests, or are China's global interests expanding because it's building and planning to build more military bases abroad? But the report really answers that question pretty well, I think. It says, China's increasing overseas military presence reflects its interest and willingness to use military force to defend its growing overseas assets. China's global security activities likely will continue to increase as the population of Chinese nationals overseas grows along with Chinese overseas economic activity and national interests. End quote. So it's clear to these authors of this report that China's increasing economic investment and involvement in Africa and Latin America and other places that we've written about several times, because that's steadily increasing, we can expect the military presence to follow in many of these areas. So it's like all of that economic activity sort of paves the way for military bases. And then there's another sobering assessment in this report about the rising tensions between China and Japan. It says, the risk of escalation in tensions between China and Japan in the East China Sea and miscalculation or accidental collision between Chinese and Japanese ships and aircraft has grown. We've seen this with the first instances of the Chinese Navy sailing within 24 nautical miles of the disputed Senkaku Islands, the increased size of Chinese Coast Guard ships patrolling there, and the growing frequency of scrambles of Japanese fighter aircraft against Chinese aircraft. So I think these are some accurate and important conclusions that this congressional committee has come to. And it takes on even more importance in light of what you spoke about at the beginning of the program there, U.S. President-elect Donald Trump coming into power very soon. And he has often spoken during the campaign about his desire to scale back America's role as the global policeman. So such a stance would basically pave the way for China to keep on building more and more overseas hubs and just, you know, to keep on pushing against the established global order in every way that it can. And I think that all of this is especially significant in light of what Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has written about in our July 2016 issue. There's an article in there called China is Steering the World Toward War. And one short quote from that just says, China is challenging 7 decades of American naval dominance. This should alarm the world. China is intimidating the nations of Southeast Asia into submission to its will. It's forcing these countries to do it at once. Everything is headed in the direction of war. So I think this congressional report just proves how accurate that statement was made. And for any listeners who have not read it, I would encourage them to go to thetrumpet.com and check out that article called China is Steering the World Toward War.
Yeah, excellent. I've covered that very well. I appreciate that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. Another aspect of Donald Trump coming to power involves his promised support for the state of Israel. There are actually a number of things that seem to be going Israel's way these days. But one observer says Israel shouldn't be too optimistic about these developments. To learn about this, we're going to turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
So we have a story in the Trumpet Weekly entitled Everyone Loves Israel Until They Don't. And I would encourage people when they get the Trumpet Weekly to click on the link so you can read the article in full. And especially those people that see Israel right now as being in a nice spot as far as its relations go with other people in the world. We've noted how Israel has fallen, the support from America has diminished over the past 8 years for Israel. And yet in the wake of that, or in the vacuum created there, Israel has reached out to other nations, Russia, China, and other Middle Eastern nations, including Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Turkey even. Just this week was announced that Israel has announced their ambassador that is going to now be stationed in Turkey the first time in a decade or so. So it's looking kind of good for Israel right now. But this man, Robert Satloff, writing for Mosaic magazine, says that, you know, we shouldn't be deceived by these alliances and these relationships that are developing, because they're only based on an assessment of common interests that are all extremely temporary. So he writes that still, he says, at the risk of raining on the parade of what is without doubt good news for the Jewish state, I believe a warning about irrational exuberance is in order, saying that we need to be cautious here because all of these relationships are based on something that, you know, can change at the toss of a hat, flip of a coin, and then the relationship with these nations can change pretty fast.
Why don't you give us an example of one of the situations he's talking about?
Okay, so as far as looking at the Middle East, there's 3 countries right now that are friends with Israel that it could be subject to change given the change in circumstances. The first of these is Egypt, who has a president over there, al-Sisi, that is probably more supportive of Israel from anybody since Sadat for the past 40, 50 years. He is engaging with Israel often with phone calls directly to Prime Minister Netanyahu, especially against what Hamas is doing in the Gaza Strip. So you have that relationship that looks to be positive. And then you have a convergence of interests with the Sunni states led by Saudi Arabia because of the shared animosity or hatred towards Iran for what Iran's doing, since Iran's developing nuclear weapons, since Iran's on the march and Iran's enemies are Saudi Arabia, the Sunni states, and Israel. You have the Sunni states and Israel coming together. And then we have, based on probably a desire for Israel's gas reserves that have been recently found in the eastern Mediterranean, Turkey, who is pretty gas hungry right now, wanting to do deals with Israel. And yet all of these could change instantly or overnight. For example, he gives, I'll just quote him now. He says the long-term stability of any of these three realities is not a foregone conclusion. First, in Egypt's case, Egypt is a volcanic domestic change. Egypt's volcanic domestic change has probably not seen its last tremor, meaning that we saw what the Muslim Brotherhood did quickly, almost overnight, taking power once again before in 2012. And that could happen instantly right now because of the economic hardship facing Sisi's government and facing the increased presence of the people on the streets ready to riot against a failed economic plan. And then if you're looking, he says, the Gulf's under-the-table bromance with Israel will only last so long as the Gulf leaders see it as a useful component of its regional competition with revolutionary Iran. As long as Iran's there, sure, there might be an alliance between Israel and Saudi Arabia and the Gulf and the Sunni states. But if Iran is taken out of the picture, watch out. That alliance with Israel will disappear. And then he finally talks about Turkey says no one can seriously bank on any strategic continuity with a megalomaniac leader like Turkey's Erdogan at the helm of regional power. Turkey, you know, one day Erdogan could be your friend, the next day he could change. And it's interesting because these three areas that he pinpoints are three areas biblically that are destined to change. We do say that in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood likely will come into power. More radical elements will rule Egypt and toast the peace treaty with Israel. We do also say that the Sunni states will eventually turn on Israel based on Bible prophecy once Iran is taken out of the way. Then yes, they are going to turn on Israel. And then Turkey as well is prophesied to turn on Israel as well. So it's just really important to look at the world and look at this alliances with Israel and see what they're based on and whether they are easily changed, whether the circumstances change, would they still be friends with Israel? And it should be a wake-up call for those that think that Israel is in a beautiful spot as far as its relationship with nations in the world.
Yeah, it's an excellent point. And this man's observations certainly do align with Bible prophecy. We know Israel's in for some tough times ahead. I would encourage our listeners to go study into it yourself. You can see all about this in our booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy. It describes in detail the prophecies about how these other nations are going to turn against Israel. You can look for that online at thetrumpet.com. Just go under the literature tab and look for Jerusalem in Prophecy. Well, thanks for that, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. One more story before the break. During America's presidential election, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton disagreed on just about everything. But one thing they agreed on is that the federal government needs to spend more money in a massive stimulus program to improve the nation's infrastructure. Well, once Mr. Trump takes office, how might this impact America's economy? To help answer this question, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
Yes, there are actually quite a few political analysts are actually giving this issue as the credit of what gave Mr. Trump his presidential victory, in that a lot of America's infrastructure is aging, especially in the Midwest states. And his promise to update and improve this and like a jobs creation program is something that really spoke to a lot of people. Although, as the Fed chairman Janet Yellen pointed out this week, some of this program would involve up to like $1 trillion in federal spending, which could well increase the inflation we've seen in America and the federal deficit, and ultimately the national debt, which is definitely something that we've seen building for a long time. I think the last time we had a president who actually decreased the federal debt was Dwight Eisenhower.
It's a little while back.
It's been a while. The first 43 American presidents together racked up about $5 trillion in debt. George Bush doubled that to $10 trillion. Barack Obama doubled that to $20 trillion. And now it's looking that Donald Trump, to his credit, is not going to double it again. But they are projecting that he will spend about increase the debt by about $5 trillion, same as George W. Bush. That seems to be about the difference between a Republican and a Democrat these days is about $5 trillion. You either increase the debt by $5 trillion or you increase the debt by $10 trillion.
So so that's essentially the concern here, that all of these infrastructure programs that he's proposing, that the trend toward increased national debt is only going to accelerate.
Right, between the infrastructure and then maybe even some of the tax cuts, it's looking that they are projecting that the debt will increase to about $25-26 trillion total by the time Mr. Trump leaves office, if he serves two terms, which even as he himself has pointed out, though, this can't keep going forever. We only get away with it now because we're paying 1% interest. If some of our foreign creditors start demanding even 2 or 3% interest, we're using the majority of the federal budget just to pay interest payments to foreign nations. And so this is something that, I mean, the concern came up during the campaign, I guess, back this summer with Mr. Trump famously rocking financial markets with his suggestion that if the interest rates go up too high, maybe we could try to negotiate a haircut, a debt haircut like Greece did. Which is sure to affect international trade relations if we actually have to go tell nations that we can't pay this anymore. There's not enough money in America.
Right. But at some point, you run out of options, don't you?
And at some point, you just, I mean, you can't, if it gets to the point, like even like right now with our $20 trillion debt, if foreign nations start demanding like 3% interest, that's our entire budget. You can't,
right.
you wouldn't be able to increase tax rates enough to leave people enough money to feed themselves and still pay off these obligations. Run into a default.
And like it, like the proverb says, the borrower is servant to the lender. Eventually, you end up having to pay for what you spent. Well, we appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about more evidence of Iran meddling in Yemen, China's new aircraft carrier, more and more churches in America embracing same-sex marriage, and who is the new leader of the free world? We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Some extraordinary headlines this past week. When Americans elected Donald Trump, many people said, okay, the President of the United States is no longer the leader of the free world. He doesn't represent the interests of the rest of the world. America is no longer the defender of the world that it once was. So who is? Well, there seems to be a consensus emerging that it is whoever is leading Germany. To longtime Trumpet readers, to readers of The Plain Truth before us, to longtime followers of Herbert W. Armstrong, this is extraordinary. The headlines are an amazing fulfillment of exactly what he said would happen. For this story, we're going to go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Yes, this has been one of the, I guess, not something I necessarily thought through before Donald Trump was elected, but just the way the whole world is now looking to Germany. And we talked a little bit about this last week. But since then, there's just been an explosion of news coverage and other coverage about how, with America stepping back in the world, Germany now sits in that leadership role. So, for example, you have the New York Times writing Donald Trump's election leaves Angela Merkel as the liberal West's last defender. And writing that an increasingly divided Europe is looking to Germany, its richest power, to cope with many problems. There is a pressure on Germany to take a greater role in European security, just like we talked about at the start there. Then the foreign policy had an article titled The Dawn of Pax Germanica, which has that for something that ties in just dramatically with Bible prophecy, talking about how, well, they write, Berlin is suddenly much more important to maintaining any semblance of the current order, for the simple reason that there is no one else to take the wheel. So Pax Americana now turning over to Pax Germanica. Another article from The Guardian, Germany daunted by great expectations as Obama passes baton to Merkel. And many people saw Mr. Obama's visit to Germany this week as a passing of the baton, a passing of the torch, as another article put it. So you're just getting all of these stories now from all around the world, showing the world focused on Germany, which you know, if you think about it, just a few years ago, if America was stepping back from the world, then everyone would be talking about Britain or France or maybe the European Union as a whole as being the kind of the default number two that's now having to step up and take that mantle of world leader. But the fact that now that it's Angela Merkel, that it's Germany, that is just kind of the default and the consensus choice for being the successor to America is just really remarkable.
It just feels like this moment of this really is like a threshold that we've crossed here. It is one of those the fall of the Berlin Wall scale fulfillments of Bible prophecy. With what you see happening in the United States and the way that this is affecting America's role in the world, but the way that this has really vaulted Germany to the forefront is truly extraordinary. Anybody who's been following these prophecies for any length of time has to just be astounded to see a headline that talks about the dawn of Pax Germanica.
Yeah, exactly. Now, as I think there have been some people pointing out, this is quite tough now for Angela Merkel, though. There was an article the Washington Post wrote called "Is Angela Merkel the Leader of the Free World Now?" And they concluded not quite. And they cited, you know, all of this pressure now on Germany to step up, the way the world is looking to Germany, how Germany is the de facto leader of Europe, etc. But then they note that Merkel's job has become infinitely harder, that Donald Trump's election is helping right wing, you know, the things like the Alternative for Deutschland and competitors within Germany. And so they write, so it is whether she can exceed, whether the United States can remain her partner in this endeavor is now uncertain. So is whether she can succeed against the odds that are piling up against her. So as the world looks to Germany, we're also seeing now just this increased pressure on the German chancellor. And remember that there's still kind of other crises now within Europe that are on everyone's horizon. There's a referendum coming up in Italy that could throw Europe into chaos. So there is really, she is in a very, very tough position. And that's something else we've been talking about now, is looking for a strong man in Germany. And you could see as well how this pressure on Germany could just put extra pressure on that strong man to emerge as well.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely true. And you just think about the crises that that the world is presenting right now, and you really do have to have strong leadership that is commensurate to meet those challenges. And if Germany is being thrust into the spotlight and everybody is looking to Germany, then it is absolutely obvious to see how important it would be that the right individuals step up. And you could see how easy it would be for once people have a sense that this is our man, that they would throw all kinds of weight and support behind him and could really vault him to unprecedented level of power very rapidly.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and you just see the pressure on Europe from so many angles, and the number of people now, even within Europe, not just within Germany, but within Europe, that are saying we need more leadership from Germany. I think it was the Dutch foreign minister, or certainly a high-ranking Dutch government member, was calling on Germany to step up, to do more. And you're seeing this with the European army. Everyone's kind of looking at Germany for leadership. And part of that is because Germany controls the purse strings. So it needs Germany's backing to happen. So you can see now other nations more and more looking to Germany already. And when with a capable leader in there really addressing some of these problems head on, you could see how that would only increase.
Very exciting stuff, Richard. We appreciate you bringing that to us. Richard mentioned these headlines, these articles that he's talking about. Each week, the staff of The Trumpet produces a digest of the important news of the week to keep you up to date. It's called The Trumpet Weekly. We offer it to you for free. You can receive it each week via email every Friday. In our Trumpet Weekly this week, we have a couple of stories about Iran's recent activities, including one story about its continual violations of the nuclear deal. That's according to the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency. Another of these stories is about Iran's ongoing activity in Yemen. For this, we're going to go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
So this is a story we've been covering quite thoroughly for the past 2 years, ever since the takeover of the Houthi rebels, Shiite militant group that have taken over the capital and most of the north western part of Yemen along the Red Sea. They are backed by Iran, supported by Iran, and there's just more and more and more proof that's coming out every single week that they are being supplied by Iran with weaponry to fight against the Saudi force, but even that's inside Yemen right now, but also against Yemen proper, the Yemenis. So they obviously want to take over that country to try and maintain control over those waterways through the Red Sea there. But what we saw this week was that there was another couple of boats that were intercepted, two that were destroyed by Arab forces led by Saudi Arabia inside the Red Sea, just off the coast of Yemen. And these were smuggling weaponry to the Houthis on the coast. And then just 2 days after that, another two boats were inspected by the Arab coalition force through the Red Sea. And in those inspections, they found arms, ammunition, and modern telecommunication equipment on board as well that were heading towards the Houthis. So what it looks like is happening to try and arm them, it isn't the Iranian ships that are docking on Yemen's coast, but rather they would dock on a couple of islands in the Red Sea there after you get through the Gulf of Aden, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, before you get to the Suez Canal. There's some islands inside the Red Sea, and that's where the Iranians would drop off their cargo. And then smaller vessels that are harder to track would then make the journey towards land once they unload from those islands so that the Houthis can get this weaponry.
As you said, we have talked a fair bit about Iran's activities in Yemen. If you could just briefly remind our listeners why this is so important to Iran, what its overall strategic objective is.
Yeah, and this, like I said at the beginning, this is something that we have tracked for a few years now, because based on Bible prophecy, we know that Iran does want to control transit through the ocean, from the Persian Gulf all the way through around the Saudi Peninsula, up the Red Sea, and into the southern Mediterranean, because it's such a critical transit point. Yes, they might not be able to extend their reach into southern Europe with their army, but they can make Europe think twice about, you know, how they're going to treat Iran if they can put in jeopardy all the oil that comes through these passageways and all the other seaborne goods that come through these passageways. So if they're going to do that successfully, we said, Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry said of the Trumpet magazine, before the Houthis took over Yemen's capital, while there was war in Yemen, it was mainly against Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. The U.S. was there, but he said that Iran would get control of that country because of this strategy. And what we're seeing now is the Houthis in firm control and Iran supplying them weaponry. And it looks like, as far as we can see, that, I mean, it's getting kind of a free pass. Yes, some of these smuggling boats are being intercepted, but you don't see the world coming down strong on Iran for intruding into another country's sovereign territory, trying to dictate who's in charge of that nation. And yet that's exactly what they're doing in Yemen.
It's amazing to watch that happen. We appreciate that, Brent. Iran is trying to get control of the Red Sea and the waterways in the Middle East. China is gaining control of the waters in Asia and even beyond. This week, it unveiled a powerful new tool it has for projecting its power on the seas. For this story, we're going to go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, on Tuesday, officials in the Chinese military said that the country's first aircraft carrier is now prepared for combat. The name of this aircraft carrier is the Liaoning, and it was originally an aircraft carrier for the Soviet Union and operated by Soviet Ukraine. But China bought it from Ukraine back in 1998, and they spent over a decade rebuilding, refitting, and refurbishing it. And then after all that work, back in 2012, the Liaoning was commissioned into the People's Liberation Army Navy. That's the Chinese Navy. But at that time, it was said to be strictly for training and testing. Chinese officials really went out of their way to say it's not a combat utility, it's only for training. But this week, all of that changed when officials announced that the Liaoning is combat ready and it is, quote, constantly prepared to fight against enemies. End quote.
I'm just wondering if anyone actually accepted at face value the statement that they had an aircraft carrier that was not for combat purposes.
Well, I think a lot of that was just logistic. They didn't have the weapons installed. They didn't have the aviation component really on board. But the indications now are that the ship has taken on its full aviation component, although the numbers have not yet been published about how many aircraft and how many soldiers are aboard. But either way, this will significantly reinforce all of China's increasingly assertive claims in the South China Sea and the East China Sea and elsewhere in its environs there. But this is also pretty powerful support, I think, of the story that we discussed in the first half, mm-hmm. just about China's intentions to build more military bases abroad, because it shows that China is taking concrete steps to be able to assert its authority and to militarily force other nations to accept its ever-expanding territorial claims. The Associated Press said that the Liaoning's upgraded status marks a milestone for a navy that has invested heavily in its ability to project power far from China's shores. And then also related to this story is that while the Liaoning is a, you know, basically a refurbished Soviet aircraft carrier, China is also now quite far into the process of constructing a second completely homegrown aircraft carrier, which will be unveiled in the years ahead. So China would still have quite a long way to go before it would catch up to America's 19 commissioned aircraft carriers, but it seems determined to close that gap. And really, once you factor will to use power into mm-hmm. that equation, China's two already would weigh more heavily than those of the U.S.
Very good. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. In an interview with 60 Minutes this week, Donald Trump affirmed that he was fine with same-sex marriage. He'll be the first man in U.S. history to be elected president holding that view. It shows just how mainstream this perspective has become in America. Mr. Trump was by far the choice of evangelical Christians. For more about this trend, we're going to turn back to Andrew Miller.
I think this is definitely one of the more ironic stories of this week, is there are actually several homosexual or LGBT groups amongst the anti-not-my-president-Trump protest this week, talking about how Donald Trump's going to deport them from the country or mm-hmm. take away their rights to same-sex marriage, even though he, like you said, he is the first president in United States history who was actually elected on a pro same-sex marriage platform, Barack Obama doing his famous flip-flop in the middle of his term. Mm-hmm. And like I said, in 60 Minutes, he's outlining what his presidency is going to look like. And he did say that he'd like to appoint some conservative justices who may overturn Roe versus Wade and make abortion a state's issue again, where a state can determine whether they want to or not. But as far as the Supreme Court case on a homosexual marriage being federally enforced, he said he's completely fine with that and it has his full support.
It's hard to know what they're so concerned about.
It is really hard to know what they're so concerned about. And it is interesting because that is the other thing is he got like 58% of the evangelical Christian vote this year, Mr. Trump did, 60% of the Catholic vote. Actually, if you go to like white evangelical Christian, he got up like 80% of the vote. So it does seem that it is coming to backing with like rural white Christian people is a huge demographic for Mr. Trump's victory. But you can start to see when you're looking at the position America's churches are taking today, why he would adopt a platform like that is that increasingly even the so-called conservative Christian churches in America are taking a pro-homosexual marriage platform. They said amongst American Christians overall, they said about 54% say they support homosexual marriage, about the same as society at large. Or as far as society at large, it's about 55%. So the churches are definitely a reflection of society. If you try to narrow the demographic down to just about Republicans, then it's about maybe only about a third of Republicans say they're fine with same-sex marriage. And if, and again, if you try to narrow the churches down to specifically like evangelical Christians, again, it's about a third say they're fine with same-sex marriage. I think actually almost kind of ironically, I think the Catholic Church is one of the more, at least American Catholics, more pro-homosexual churches you can belong to, with about 60% saying that they're fine with same-sex marriage here in America.
Massive change. I mean, it was certainly the churches that were the most resistant to this change within society, but now they are tending to go along in some pretty strong numbers.
Right, and it, like I said, it is about half of those, if you identify all the Christian denominations, are supporting of this, which is a big change from just, 10 years ago, and a huge change from 20 years ago. So they are starting to see that despite what some of these protesters may be starting to claim, is that even these conservative evangelical Christians that are were such a big part of the Trump coalition, this is not an issue for them anymore. This is just there might be a little bit behind the curve of the rest of America, the direction the rest of American society is already trending to, but they're definitely trending in that direction as well.
You know, this is a very, very important subject. We have a booklet about it called Redefining Family that addresses the specific. There's actually a section in there that talks about churches and religious people who purport to believe the Bible, who then go along with this doctrine, which is very much contrary to what the Bible teaches about this. But it specifically addresses the tendency in society to just go along with it. Well, you know, what's the point of fighting it? And it doesn't really affect me. And that type of thing. But it really explains why it is such a damaging teaching, and why it is something that we all really do need to be deeply concerned about. It also talks about it exposes the way that this agenda was implemented within the United States in order to effect this radical social change, and just how underhanded the effort has been to undermine this institution that has really underpinned human civilization for thousands of years. It really is a very important subject that every single listener needs to make sure that you're proving this, and not just kind of bouncing along and going along with the standard public, common, accepted teaching that is becoming more and more mainstream, and really make sure that you understand why you believe what you believe on this very, very important subject. I would really encourage any listener to go online to thetrumpet.com under the literature tab and look up that booklet, Redefining Family, and check it out for yourself. Well, we appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. And we want to give you a free subscription to The Trumpet Weekly. This is our weekly news report where we compile all of the stories that we talked about on the program today and a whole lot more. We put everything we possibly can in about 12 pages to really bring you up to date with the most important news of the week from around the world. We're going to finish the program with our lightning round of important news from our panelists. That is coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some headlines that caught our attention from this week, and we'll start with Andrew.
A massive earthquake hit the South Island of New Zealand just after midnight on Monday. The earthquake, originally measured at a 7.5, but has now been reconfirmed to be a 7.8, making it one of New Zealand's biggest four earthquakes in the last 150 years.
and now to Jeremiah.
In another sign of increasing cooperation between Russia and India, the leaders of the two nations intervened this week to salvage a massive trade deal between a Russian firm and an Indian company that seemed doomed for failure. Originally, Russia's state-owned oil giant Rosneft had been planning to buy India's Essar oil firm, but then Saudi Arabia stepped in last year and offered India a lot more money, billions of dollars more. So it looked like the Russians were outbid and there was nothing that could be done. But then Russian President Vladimir Putin and Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi both got personally involved in this deal, and they were able to negotiate a price and keep Saudi Arabia out of this strategic acquisition. So the final price was $13 billion, making it the biggest ever foreign acquisition in India and Russia's largest outbound deal ever.
All right, we'll now go to Richard.
Had some interesting news from German politics this week. The ruling coalition has decided on who they want as Germany's next president, and that is the German foreign minister, Frank-Walter Steinmeier. Now, this is very interesting for a couple of reasons. One is he is probably the most outspokenly anti-Trump politician within Germany. He called Donald Trump a hate preacher in the run-up to the election. And the other interesting factor is in this is who would then replace him as foreign minister. Now, one of the top names being talked about for that is actually former German defense minister Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg. Now, he hasn't shown much interest in the role. I haven't seen any politicians talking about it. It was mainly a newspaper article saying, hey, this would be a great guy for the job. But considering that he's been out of politics for several years and shown no interest in coming back to politics, it's remarkable that people are there still trying to co-opt him and conscript him for such, you know, really one of the top, kind of the top two or three positions within Germany as foreign minister there. So very interesting development. And then also just today, German Chancellor Angela Merkel called a press conference for Sunday. And the speculation is there that she is going to announce that she was going to run for a fourth term as German Chancellor in the elections in 2017. So we've got lots to watch in German politics.
And now to Brent.
According to a Reuters report released on Wednesday, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has plans that could possibly extend his term until 2029 if they are accepted in a referendum next spring. The president has argued that Turkey needs to have a strong executive branch in order to prevent the weakness of the current coalition governments. Erdogan's critics, of course, have accused him of trying to use the ruling to extend his own term. If the referendum is passed, the constitution's two-term limit would be reset, meaning Erdogan, if reelected, could rule for another 10 years.
Back over to Andrew.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau arrived in Cuba on Tuesday for his first official state visit to the island. He met with President Raul Castro to hammer out some trade deals. This move comes immediately after the election of Donald Trump, who has promised to try to reverse some of the Cuba trade deals that the Obama administration has enacted in the past year.
All right, back over to Jeremiah.
Russia said on Wednesday that in accordance with the wishes of President Vladimir Putin, it is quitting the International Criminal Court. An official statement said that they made that decision because the organization has, quote, failed to meet the expectations to become a truly independent, authoritative international tribunal. So this is another massive black eye for those international bodies that were supposed to bring peace to the world. And right after it happened, the Philippines said, if Russia's quitting, we're probably going to quit too.
All right, now to Richard.
The Royal Navy is getting rid of its anti-ship missiles due to cost-cutting. It's going to rely now only on naval guns for the next couple of years. Navy sources, according to the Telegraph, said that this decision was like Nelson deciding to get rid of his cannons and go back to muskets. It's really a remarkable decision. The ranges on these weapons, you know, the range of guns versus missiles is just absolutely tiny. They have a range of 17 compared to the missiles with 80. And then even when the Navy gets missiles again, they're going to be helicopter launched rather than being launched from the ship. So Britain's ships will only be able to fire in smooth seas and when conditions are relatively good. So just some absolutely incredibly short-sighted decisions from Britain's Navy there.
Okay, we'll go to Brent.
On November 15, Egypt's highest court of appeal overturned a death sentence against former President Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood. The deposed president had been facing execution since June last year for his role in a mass jailbreak in 2011. While still in prison, the court of appeal said that the Morsi trial would go to retrial. The court ruling came 5 days after Egyptian authorities announced that they had foiled a coordinated terrorist attack by the Muslim Brotherhood, indicating that an Egyptian revolt is once again simmering under the surface.
And one last item from Andrew.
Retiring California Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer introduced legislation to Congress on Tuesday to scrap the U.S. Electoral College. This bill comes after a controversy in the recent election where Hillary Clinton won the popular vote across the United States, even though Donald Trump got a majority of the state-level electors. Chances of the bill passing, though, are still really slim, considering the Republicans control both houses of Congress and three-quarters of the states would have to ratify a constitutional amendment.
Yeah, and it would be a terrible, terrible idea. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'd be happy to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories that we discuss on Trumpet Hour are in The Trumpet Weekly and a whole lot more on top of that. You can email us and give us your thoughts about the program at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Nachtigall.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Wendell Berry. No matter how much one may love the world as a whole, one can live fully in it only by living responsibly in some small part of it. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.